Over the course of a semester, the University of Arkansas School of Law hosts several visiting legal scholars to discuss any number of topics related to the law and legal education. On our program just this semester, we've heard from experts in everything from property law to providing counseling to help law students. A recent visitor in the speaker exchange, Eric Carpenter, was on campus to discuss military law. An associate professor of law at Florida International University, Carpenter has been both a prosecutor and defender in the military judicial system. During his visit here, he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. He says there are several misconceptions about the military judicial system.
For the military justice system is that it's unfair, right? So it turns out that it's actually pretty similar to the civilian system. It's fair in a lot of ways. Everybody gets a defense counsel. Doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. You get a defense counsel. They're well-trained. The defense counsel aren't overloaded with cases, so they actually have time to work on your case, as opposed to in a lot of cities, the defense counsel might have 200 or 300 cases. They might talk to their client like once. And in the military justice system, your defense counsel is really going to be working hard on your case. So it turns out that's really fair, and I tell a lot of people that if I was innocent, I would much rather be in the military justice system because it's pretty accurate. That might not be a good thing if you're guilty, right, because they're going to figure out that you are guilty and probably convict you. But it's a fair, just system. And the differences that are in the system tend not to be anything that should cause people to be spooked about it.
Yeah. Are there any procedural differences? I mean, I'm sure there are some.
The number one thing is that a prosecutor or a career prosecutor is not the person making the prosecutorial decision in a case. It's still the unit commander, right? So the ultimate decision about whether to send a case to a court-martial is up to somebody that's not a lawyer, right? They're going to be just a really high-ranking officer. And that's an area that's still under criticism from Congress and others. But they make that decision with a senior attorney giving them advice on what to do in the case. But that's unique. And then the other thing that's really unique about the military system is the jurors are hand-selected by that convening authority, by the general officer. So the person that's deciding to send a case to trial is also the one that's hand-selecting jurors. And you don't see that in the civilian community, right? It's you're entitled to a trial by the jurors or by your peers. And so they gather up a bunch of people from the community, and that's who your case is tried in front of. So that's not the case in the military. And those are the two most fundamental differences.
To people on the outside, they might hear that and go, wait, a handpicked jury? That sounds like a deck could be stacked.
It could be. There's a bunch of protections in place. There are pretty good voir dire rules, which are rules about how you can question the jurors and whether the military judge should grant challenges for cause, which are all pretty good. But it turns out that the people that are selected, and I was a defense counsel for 4 years, so I could have come into this with the panels were terrible. But it turns out that they take their job seriously. They do it without influence from the commander. They look hard at the cases. They quit. They come back with light sentences sometimes. And I've never actually seen a case where a panel has come back and done something that I thought was outrageous, right? So my client might have thought it was outrageous, but, you know, the kind of neutral person to me would say, that's actually a fairly accurate result and the punishment's not normatively out of whack. So it turns out they're still pretty fair. It just the process looks kind of odd, but it's really not an unfair system.
I guess another difference is you as the defense attorney, you're getting paid the same no matter what.
I mean,
your payday does not depend on how well it goes for your client.
Correct. And the defense bar in the military comes from the JAG Corps. Right? So they're getting paid the same as the prosecutors, and you go back and forth. So you might be I was a prosecutor for a year. Then I went and got another law degree, and then I was a defense counsel for 4 years. And you can go back and forth. It has equal status in the system. You're getting the same amount of pay. And the pay in the military for the uniformed attorneys is actually higher than it would be in most civilian justice systems. So it turns out to be a pretty fair arrangement.
When you're an attorney in this situation in the military, is that your sole job?
It depends on the service.
Okay.
But for the most part, it is. Army, Navy, Air Force, you're going to be a judge advocate, and that's pretty much all you're going to do. And you're going to rotate within different jobs every couple of years. So you might do criminal law, and you might go do administrative law or operational law, like law of war kind of stuff. The Marine Corps, you can technically go out and be a regular line officer, but they still tend to do nothing but kind of JAG work for their careers. But it's principally what you do.
When you're in that role, are you defending, prosecuting any number of sort of things? It could be from theft to sexual assault to you name it?
Yep. So we try to start people off with the easier cases, but that's not always what comes up first. So when I was a supervising defense counsel, once one of my subordinate defense counsel, his first case was a contested rape case, which is kind of unusual, right? Usually out in the civilian world, you've got to work your way up from misdemeanor bench trials to something else until you finally graduate up to the felony trials. So they come much more quickly. The complex cases come much more quickly in a JAG's career, but they also have the best training possible, right? So the training that JAG's get, particularly in the Army but in all the services, is top-notch. It's as good as any in the country, and they're well-supervised. So even if though we may be giving them complex cases to start with, they've got a lot of people guiding them along the way. It's not just throwing them into the ocean and seeing if they can swim.
I think one reason that there probably isn't as much understanding about military judicial system is, one, almost all of us have had some sort of civilian experience, right? Either whether unfortunate enough to be in a courtroom or be part of the jury selection or know someone. Not everyone has been on that side.
Correct. And now the percentage of people that are in the military as a part of our population is down about 1%. Mm-hmm. So now it turns out that the biggest moments of reform in the military justice system have been after large amounts of people have been exposed to it. So like after World War II, that's when we scrapped the old system and got the new system, because a bunch of people went through what back then was an extraordinarily unfair system. They came back, and everyone can vote, and their parents can vote. So they scrapped that system. And then during Vietnam, when we had another huge mobilization, people saw things that were unfair in the system, and there was another big moment of reform. So it tends to be that when lots of people are exposed to it, we get reform movements about the odd things. And those two big reform movements are what made the system much more of like kind of a civilianized system, so that the differences don't really are hard to notice. I mean, people are wearing uniforms in a courts martial, but other than that, you could jump into one of those and they look pretty standard. And the current reform movement is much more about victims of sexual assault who have come together and said, this part of the system still is not working correctly. And they've been able to gather some political power and make another batch of reforms, which is what we're currently undergoing in the military justice system. And the odd thing is, in the other reform movements were much more about that the system is really unfair towards the accused or the person that's been charged with an offense, with the idea that commanders are just railroading people and that the system is just unfair for the accused. This current reform movement is about commanders not doing enough, right, so that they're not prosecuting enough. And we've got a movement to give more victim protections, particularly for that class of victims who've been the victim of a sexual assault, and actually making it and trying to find ways to make it almost easier to prosecute a class of offenders. So we're actually seeing things swing the other direction towards maybe the accused have gotten too many rights in the military, and we want to scale back on some of those.
When reform happens, you mentioned that it might be initiated by people who are part of the accusatory class. Mm-hmm. I don't know legal terms. But how does it have to happen? Who do you finally have to influence to have reform happen? Who are the decision makers?
Ultimately, it's Congress. Mm-hmm. So when the military knows that, because the UCMJ was written by Congress, Congress is charged by the Constitution with doing that work. When Congress gets fed up with the Department of Defense saying we're going to fix things and then things aren't fixed, that's when Congress gets involved. And that's traditionally doesn't happen very often. DOD will see that there's a problem, or Department of Defense will see that there's a problem, go in and make the fixes, and then Congress kind of backs away. But in the 2000s, Congress was not seeing the Department of Defense making the reforms it thought it ought to make. And that's when they came in and made a bunch of changes. And those changes have been happening since about 2007 all the way up until there was a huge act passed in 2016 called the Military Justice Act, which was, you know, as big a moment as we saw after World War II and after during Vietnam in terms of changing things. Because Congress got fed up waiting, hearing the Department of Defense saying, we're making changes, and then they weren't seeing any results. So I expect we're going to go through a little period when Congress will be like, okay, let's see what happens. Let's let the dust settle. And if they're still not satisfied with results, then I think we might see reform in terms of actually getting at the last two kind of things that are left in the military justice system that are unique, which is the commanders running it and commanders picking panels. That's about the last – all that's left.
That is
– yeah. That's really, really unique to the military. There's small differences that don't really matter. Yeah, but I think if we don't see a significant difference, and particularly how sexual assault cases are processed, that those things might be taken out in another 5 or 6 years. And so we'll kind of see what if these reforms have had any impact or not, and then see what Congress does. But Congress is ultimately the one that makes the changes.
And I guess as over time the military changes demographically and things like that, you have to examine how this works.
And I was giving a talk earlier about that there probably has always been a problem of sexual assault in the military once the integration started up in full force. And we're still sort of even in that process. The certain branches of the Army or certain jobs that were in the Army and in the Marine Corps were segregated still until very recently. So we're going to go through another moment of really fully integrating all the services. The Marine Corps, they may be on the way out of having segregated basic courses, right, mm-hmm. where the women are doing training in one part of the base and the men are doing training on the other. And so we're still in the process of just getting people fully integrated. And I think eventually once everyone's fully integrated, they understand the value that everyone's bringing to the table, there'll be more of a kind of a movement in terms of treating all the sexual assault cases as seriously as any other kind of assault on any other service member.
And then, of course, beyond the courts, I mean, the goal, right, is to have just fewer sexual assaults.
Yep.
I mean, deal with it before it ever becomes an issue in a court.
Correct. And that's actually one of the punchlines from some of my research is we're doing a lot of tinkering with law and policy, trying to get after holding offenders accountable. Because there's three things they're really trying to do. They're trying to prevent sexual assault in the first place, take care of victims if there is a sexual assault, and then also hold victims accountable. Most of the attention has been on how do we hold the offenders accountable. The military has done a lot of good work on how to take care of victims. And they're probably leading the country. I'm certain they're leading the country on how to take care of victims once there's been an assault. The military is still not particularly good on directing, and Congress also, in terms of directing energy towards prevention. And they could spend, you know, cents on the dollar on the front end with certain security measures that would make it so that it's much more difficult to commit a sexual assault, at least on base or something. And if you prevent that sexual assault, then you don't have to spend the hundreds of dollars afterwards, you know, prosecuting that case. Very minor things like so on bases, they're things that are essentially like dorms. We call them barracks. Mm-hmm. But a lot of those don't have very basic physical security measures in them, like security cameras or swipe card access or even a real security guard, not another soldier kind of watching who's coming in and out, but an actual independent security guard. And if we had those things, it would probably serve as a deterrent to committing a sexual assault in a barracks. But it's also great for gathering evidence. So, right, if the case does pop up, well, now we know who's been in and out of rooms because we have swipe cards. We know who's been in up and down the hallway because we've got the video cameras and people logging in and out. We can see the state of a victim, like just how intoxicated she was compared to how intoxicated the accused was as they're walking up and down the hallway. And so we're ignoring some of that, and I think spending the money where in that phase where we could get a lot of good results, and we're still kind of wrapped up just focusing in on what happens if there is an assault. And some of my research has been showing that, and the research I am working on right now is showing that changing the law and doing those sorts of things really doesn't have an impact on case processing anyway, in any event, because the belief systems that might cause a case to drop out of being prosecuted can still wiggle their way into other parts of the law. So it could be that the very best things that, we can be doing spending money is, I call it debiasing, but training commanders and law enforcement officials and other people in the military justice system the realities behind sexual assault so they can spot it in the cases they're working, and spending money on prevention efforts rather than just, you know, trying to find some new area in the law to tinker with.
Eric Carpenter is an associate professor of law at Florida International University in Miami and was recently on the University of Arkansas campus to speak at the School of Law. This is Ozarks at Large.